Produced by Jeffrey Griselius, Joseph Cottrell and Ken Fuller, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 613, Yes Iconography.
Hi, this is Trevor Rabin and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 613 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along in a few moments. You can always get involved with the podcast via various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week's episode is a rather visual one, so you'll probably want to listen after, or concurrently with, looking at the images on the show notes over at yesmusicpodcast.com. Mark and I discuss some of the most instantly identifiable, for Yes fans, images which don't include the name of the band. We start off with a quiz for Mark using a set of non-Yes icons, and then we head off down Yes, John Anderson, Roger Dean, and some other associated rabbit holes. All of this was kicked off for me by my interest in the tiny circular icons on the inner gatefold sleeve of Tales from Topographic Oceans. I posted a photo of them on Instagram, and you won't be surprised to know that lots of people recognised them immediately. This is one of those in-the-weeds episodes, so I hope you find it entertaining. Around the socials this week, and specifically the YMP discussion group on Facebook, Bill Hayes posted a YouTube video by Classic Album Review, which goes into the arguments for and against the legitimacy of the current Yes lineup. I'm sure you can imagine the heated debate in the comments. And Paul Hales added a great photo of the Marquee Club with a poster advertising Jimi Hendrix and Chris Squire's band, Sin. Doug Curran's list this week included the new Roger Dean Jigsaws, available now. Geddy Lee talking about Trevor Horn in his new book, My Effin' Life. News that on a recent late night with Stephen Colbert, a TV show on CBS, Colbert said Locust Centrifuge was the name of his prog rock band in college. That's excellent. Then showed a doctored photo of Chris Squire to illustrate the point. The frankly amazing video of King Crimson with Bill Bruford on drums and David Cross on mellotron and violin, playing live on the Midnight Special show hosted by the Bee Gees on October the 12th, 1973. And a happy birthday to the one and only Tony Kaye. Geoffrey Mason's contributions included another happy birthday to Tony Kaye, a video purporting to show Steve Howe's net worth and described by Geoffrey as nightmare fuel for its AI text and creepy artwork. News that vocalist Molly Marriott will join Rick Wakeman for his return of the Caped Crusader UK tour. Neil McCormick's great article for The Telegraph on the role of the Hammond organ in the history of rock. A happy 80th birthday to Jimmy Page, the brief Squire and White XYZ collaborator. And news of a new Yes book in French. Steve Perry pointed us towards an article covering how Phil Collins almost joined Yes twice. And Stephen Schinder celebrates Yes Shift Podcast's latest episode about the birthday boy Tony Kaye. H.B. Peterson spotted an article describing how Owner of a Lonely Heart made the record company breathe down the band's necks all the time afterwards about a new hit. Joost Maglev on X.com asked, was this article written by AI? Was an awful, uninformative piece of work. So read that at your own risk. Congratulations to Sonic Bond and Stephen Lamb for launching their new website. Head over to sonicbondpublishing.co.uk for all your prog and rock reading needs. And Stephen Zavechin, hope that's pronounced correctly, has finished Yes, the Tormato story by me. And he thinks it's good. Thank you very much. Mike X. Hanratty has been watching the first episode of Fargo, which features Your Move. And Brian Sullivan shared Richard Ireson's bass cover of Yours Is No Disgrace, which is very good. As always, thank you to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week, including the commenters on last week's show notes, Doug Curran, Greg Clinton and Jeremy North.
Yes Music Podcast, 12 True Summers.
We're well into 2024 now, and Mark is here with me again to get deeply into the weeds about some icons. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm not doing too badly at all. What about you?
Actually having an enjoyable day this morning. I took the dog out, and we were blessed with 2 centimeters of snow, very Lovely. Little, but it was a nice quiet walk outside with the dog. He enjoyed it. He loves snow. He's a snow dog. And it was very nice, and the weather is very pleasant, surprisingly. But we are doomed to get into the negative 10s and 15s next week.
Oh, blimey. Okay. Well, yeah. It's supposed to be... has been cold here in the UK as well, but no snow where I am, fortunately. Although, having said fortunately, our dog also loves the snow, so yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So, let's get back to this idea this week, which is about the iconography. It's about the little pictures and things and visual elements of, I suppose, the record packaging of Yes. But before we get into Yes, I'm sure you listening can think of many bands' icons and logos which don't contain the name of the band at all, but you still know exactly what the band or artist is immediately. And I'm going to give Mark a little test now. I've sent him 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pretty obvious, to be honest, logos, but let's see if he can get them and tell us a little bit about them. So you'll have to use your imagination in this first bit anyway. So, Mark, what about that first one on the left there?
So the first one, I'm guessing you're talking about the one that has the Sozo and all that there.
Yep.
So that's the icon associated with Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those little icons represent a member of the band.
Yeah.
From what I understand. Now, my good friend Vance, he would be able to go into like 3 hours worth of discussions for each of those ones because he's a Led Zeppelin fanatic.
Yes.
But... yeah, they're supposed to represent each member of the band. I'm guessing that the Zozo is for Jimmy Page,
yeah.
I think, and I believe that the three circles is Bonham, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm guessing that the feather is always the one I'm always not too sure about. I'm guessing maybe the feather could be Robert Plant.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know exactly, but I did look it up, and apparently it was a bit of a sideswipe from the band, and particularly Page, I think, at the record company, because the record company said, you know, whatever you produce, people will buy it as long as they know that it's got Led Zeppelin on the cover. And he was upset by this. And so he decided for the fourth album, just called Four, isn't it? That they wouldn't put Led Zeppelin on the album cover at all. They would come up with some diagrams, some icons to as you say, to mean each member of the band. So that's what they did. Yep, and very, very quickly and instantly recognisable by most rock fans. Yes. What about the next one there? It's got a bit of a circle on top and an arrow going down, and yeah, what's that?
Well, if my memory is correct, I'm pretty sure this is Prince. Now,
yes.
The thing with Prince is that I think his story with this is probably sort of similar to Zeppelin in the sense that he didn't want to be identified as, you know, Prince, like with a name. He wanted to just be represented with simply being a symbol, right? And I guess that he proved again that, you know, he could sell music and albums, you know, even without his name being yes. on the cover. He could just put an image on there and people would know what it is, especially people who are diehard Prince people.
Yes,
would course. Know immediately what that symbol is. And once they see it, they're going to go and snap up those records. So it's like, again, it's another one of those, you know, throwing it in the face of the man, as they would say. Right?
Yes, absolutely. And the one little story I remember hearing, I don't know whether it's true or not, is part of the reason why he did this was to avoid some kind of litigation. So that he sat in a room with the accusers, with the legal teams of people who had copyright, I don't know what it was, some kind of legal thing against him. And they said, Now, Prince, we have these things to discuss with you. And he refused to answer to the name Prince because he had officially changed his name to this symbol.
Yes.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm sure someone can tell. Anyway, so that's what he was up to with that, again, now very recognisable symbol. Now, the next one is, you won't hesitate with this one at all, with big red lips and a big tongue sticking out. So who's that?
Is that Jim Nabors? No, it's actually a Rolling Stones. That's a very identifiable one there. You know, you couldn't get that mistaken with anything else. That's for sure. Now, this one, from what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong with this, I'm pretty sure this was done more for promotional reasons. Mm. Not mm. It wasn't like to stick it to the record company. I think this was merely to help them with their promotion of live concerts and stuff like that, to have themselves an image or an icon that is closely associated with the band, so that when they did promote concerts and stuff like that on posters, you know, it was something that very much stuck out and jumped out of the page, and people, you know, can relate to it. 'Cause if you think about it, back in the days, then there was so much promotion going on and stuff like that. And even in Toronto, you would walk down the streets of Toronto and there'd be like concert promotion posters littering the walls of the cities everywhere, like tons of them. And, you know, everybody's fighting for space. Everybody's fighting to be seen. And there's a lot of like different dates and stuff like that to see. And what are you going to look at? So when you see this, right away, you know, like, okay, this is the Rolling Stones. And it kind of jumps out of the page when you see that image, especially back in the 70s, I'm sure, when they did it, it was something to be seen, right? So, and probably there wasn't any other sort of an image as close to that in certain terms of like noticeability as this one was, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I think I remember reading fairly recently that it's another one of those icons that just instantly recognizable symbols that everyone knows now, but it was created by, I think it was someone who was on a course, who was on a graphic design course, and they got paid very little for it, and yet now it's an essential icon. Yep, that's that one. And the next one, again, we've got two more left. This one certainly won't challenge you at all.
I wonder what this one could possibly be. Well, obviously, it's the Rush Starman symbol, insignia. The funny thing with this one, though, and me being a diehard Rush fan, I mean, this would have been absolutely shameful if I didn't know what this one was. Yes. But the thing with this is that it originally started out as just a star image on the 2112 cover, right? Then later on, when they did Hemispheres, that's where they had the image of the naked man on top of the brain. Right. And then they kind of combined those two images to make this one. So the whole Starman thing was a combination of that, because originally the star was on 2112, which was representative of a collective. The star represents the collective. And then the man represents the individual. So the individual against the collective. Sort of imagery, right? Yes. And Neil Peart was all about that. He was all about Ayn Rand books in the beginning, and, you know, reading stuff like Anthem and Fountainhead and all those books about, you know, like Anthem is a novelette, basically just talking about how there was a society that was all in very much in order, run in a certain order, and then there was no individuals in this.
Yes.
You know, so, and when this individual found a guitar and brought it to the high priest, they knew all about the guitar, and it was looked at as a symbol of, you know, it was like a bad symbol in their eyes. So, because it kind of, you know, promoted like a sort of separatist view, right? Individualism. Yeah. So, and they didn't want that, right? So this sign became kind of synonymous with that way of thinking, you know, the man against the machine, or man against the government, or man against the big corporation, you know?
That's good. That's good. I like that. Excellent explanation there. All right, then. Well, the last one before we get on to Yes itself is perhaps Hipgnosis's best known logo. I mean, it's, you know, this is one of the ones that I suppose Rolling Stone was one a bit, but this is the one that you see on T-shirts worn by young people who haven't a clue what it actually means. But it's just one of those, again, iconic images, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's the funny thing about this whole image is that the amount of kids that don't have a clue what they're wearing when they wear this shirt is unbelievable. Now, I don't really know too much of the interpretation of this thing, but there is something here that I've seen before that says there's a little small comment about it saying there are several interpretations of the cover's art meaning. Some fans have suggested that it works as a metaphor for personal and psychological darkness, while others maintain that the prism in particular represents intellectual thought and ambition.
We haven't actually said what it is yet. It's Dark Side of the Moon.
Yes, Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd, yes. I thought that was kind of clear.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So it's the whole spectrum thing, isn't it? And
yes.
And dark one side. I suppose it's just light going in one. I can see that. So you know, again, it could be the personal, the individual, and then going through from the darkness, and you get the multicolored blast out of the other side. Yeah.
Yes.
Fascinating. Okay. Well, that's great. So we had Led Zeppelin, Prince, Rolling Stones, Rush, and Pink Floyd there with their icons. But the reason I started thinking about this was because I was looking at the inside cover of Tales from Topographic Oceans, and I sent out the four little icons, the coloured icons that you can see in there on Instagram, and said to people, do you recognise these icons? And of course, several people got back to me saying, yes, of course, they're inside, inside, and go with each of the sides of Tales from Topographic Oceans. So what we've got is the Revealing Science of God, Dance of the Dawn, which is, I think that's supposed to be an embryo,
yes.
I think. The Remembering High, the Memory, which is a picture, a cartoon-type picture of the sea. Then we've got the Ancient Giants Under the Sun, which is a stylized sun itself. And we've got Ritual, Nous Sommes du Soleil, which is... now, I looked this up because I couldn't remember the name of it. It's from a Leonardo da Vinci drawing of the Vitruvian Man. And it's a version of that, again, simplified version of that in a circle. And these are all in circles. So
yes.
Did you just see these, as I did, as interesting illustrations, Mark, when you first saw them? Or did you think that they might have more meaning than that?
Honestly, and I'll be totally honest, because our 5th percentile deserves my honesty,
yes.
And that is that I had no clue what these things were originally, because on my copy of Tales, the printing inside the album cover is so small, and it's so worn out because I have a 74 pressing of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean that's like a almost 50-year-old record. So
yes.
The printing has gotten a little faded over time. So the embryo just looked like a big green blotch on mine for some
yes.
reason. But it, in a way, if you think about it, now that you see it in such clarity, the meaning of it does become more clear, like the Revealing Science that got the embryo, the beginning of life.
Yes.
Right? So, but it's funny. As soon as I was very curious to see what you were going to say about the ancient one, because when I first saw it, I thought it was a giant beach ball. That's what it looked like at first. I was like, is that a beach ball? You know, which could have made sense. Giants under the sun, maybe they're, you know, playing on the beach or something. You know? But now that you were saying it's a stylized sun, it makes even more sense, of
yes,
course, right? I mean,
course
I don't think
does,
they would
yeah.
they would have projected a beach ball on the stage up in, on top of John there, you know.
That's very good. And it's funny, isn't it? It's like mishearing lyrics when you're,
yes.
particularly when you're younger, and you're convinced that the lyrics are certainly, you know, something or other, which is fairly comic, perhaps, and then later you find out it's not that at all. And
yeah.
perhaps it's the same with these sort of icons. And I just meant to say, actually, that it's probably best to follow along with what we're saying today by going to the show notes and actually seeing these, if you can't remember exactly what they're like, as we go through the tales and then on to some other different, yes, things.
Yes.
So yes, they go with each one of the sides, each one of the pieces, each one of the tracks on the album. And the other thing that we're not really talking about today, because it's not exactly icons, but there are photographs, aren't there, that go with each one as well, which sort of illustrate some of the concepts or ideas which are in each one of the sides. So there's clouds, and there's a sort of stormy one, and some beautiful sunset and that kind of thing. So it's all about the topographic ocean. And yes, if you read the lyrics, each one of those icons does go with each one of the songs. So, for example, the Remembering High, the Memory is all about the topographic ocean itself. So that's why they've got the ocean, the sea, little icon there for that. The Ancient Giants Under the Sun, obvious. Not beach ball, but the sun. And Ritual is an interesting one. I'm sure there are dozens of interpretations of exactly why we've got the Vitruvian Man there, but I read a little bit about it, and that was Leonardo da Vinci's version of a concept by the Roman architect Vitruvius. And what he went on about was the ideal, the perfect shape and size and dimensions of the human body. So that's what Leonardo da Vinci was trying to encapsulate. So the outstretched arms are supposed to be exactly the same length as the height of the person and all these sorts of things, which is probably deeply worrying nowadays. But the idea is that, I suppose the idea that John, and I'm assuming it was John that came up with these, was that, you know, this is the end, change we must, surely times change, the source he goes on about in the lyrics, Nous sommes du soleil, everything sort of comes back to this perfection, idea of perfection maybe. But you can put any any meaning on that you want to, I'm sure. But yes, you mentioned already that I've included in the show notes a photograph from ForgottenYesterdays.com, and this is the only one I've ever seen of this. And again, you probably have photographs yourself in your archives listening to this, but it clearly shows John Anderson playing the percussion in one of those Tales concerts in America, and above him, projected onto a kind of wing thing at the side of Alan White's kit, is the beach ball. It's the sun. I'm never going to be able to look at that now without thinking beach ball. So yes, it's the sun. So I'm assuming that was put on that display during the ancient Giants Under the Sun. And I'm assuming again, although again, I've not seen a photograph of it, but please let us know if you were at one of the Tales concerts and remember this, that for each of the different songs, they would put the appropriate icon up on that screen. And I think that's a very effective thing to do. And I rather like these. I think it's nice to have this kind of graphic element for each of the songs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it is interesting because now that you mentioned the beach ball thing, you know, maybe they're doing a cover of Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys during that.
maybe.
but the one thing that I found interesting is the remembering one, because it shows the sea, right?
Yes.
And there's always this long sort of theory that I've heard on these various channels. I like to watch these Science and Discovery channels where they're talking about the ocean being the sort of answer to most of man's questions, that if you want anything to learn about the past, you go to the ocean for the source, right? Because apparently the ocean is the oldest thing on the planet, and a lot of it has been undiscovered by man because it's so deep, right?
Yeah.
So maybe some of this maybe he could be referring to something like that, where, you know, some of the mysteries of man lie in the ocean there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, or, you know, I could be just, you know, drinking the John Anderson Kool-Aid saying that, but, you know, but I mean, but it to me, it kind of makes sense. And the whole ritual thing, I think it was very interesting how you brought up that it is sort of a disturbing sort of thing, because, you know, the whole perfect image of the body, that almost starts going back to, you know, the whole Nazi thing with the perfect man, blonde haired, blue eye thing, you know?
Yes, indeed. That's one of the sort of echoes that is not comfortable now, clearly.
Yes. Mm.
But yes, fascinating to see those there. And do let us know, yes, as I say, that if you did go to one of those concerts and they did use the other icons, I'd be fascinated to know. Absolutely. Well, there are two other elements on that cover, which I want to just mention. And the first one of those is a little diagram. And I think it's a little blue diagram underneath John Anderson's explanation of the whole concept of the album. And I think it looks to me like it's got John Anderson's signature beneath it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm imagining that this was created by John himself. Again, if you know, please let us know. And it appears to be, I don't know, a sort of landscape, is that, with a star or a sun above it, and a rock and three strange little, I don't know what it is, but it'd be great to know if you know what it is. Mark, any ideas about that?
Well, you're kind of on the right, well, I can't say right track, but you're on the same track as me with the signature. At first, when I looked at the signature, it almost looked like a satellite dish. And I was like, wait a minute, no, that does look like John, now that you mentioned it. But the imagery there on the left, it almost looks like a rip in the fabric of time, edging there. And then we're seeing into another world, and there's like a little, that little circle in the middle looks almost like a cave opening. you know, into somewhere else.
Could be.
And then there's like a sun on the left there, and it's like almost like these three, like almost like cacti images on the ground. I mean, that's what I see.
Yes.
Right? Everybody could see something different in it, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Well, again, let us know in the show notes and comments in the show notes, please, what you think that is. Or if you know what it is, then even better. Thank you. All right. And the last one, so we're going to move on from Tales and have a think about the rest of Yes's output. The last one is what I now realise is Roger Dean's icon. And it's a little bit like Da Vinci. It's a little bit like a Da Vinci drawing of an aeroplane. But it's one of those Roger Dean things where it's part machine and it seems to be part bird as well.
Yes.
And again, it's for Yes fans, this is instantly recognizable. Now, I spent many decades not thinking about this properly and thinking that that was a Yes symbol, in fact, and was based on the fragile ship, which takes off into space, doesn't it? Having looked, and we'll come back to this one in a minute, having looked through various album covers and also Views, the book by Roger Dean himself, this is his trademark, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, for the longest time, I didn't know that either until we started getting more into the sort of the deep end of Roger Dean's sort of artwork. And we started talking about more of his stuff on the episodes and stuff like that. And then you start realizing that there's certain things that always pop up with him.
Yes.
And this is one of those images that definitely become, you know, attached to him more and more as you look into his artwork. So, but yeah, at first I thought it was just something to do with the story of Tales from Topographic Oceans at first, right?
Yes.
But, you know, like you said, as you look into it further and further, it definitely is an image related to Roger Dean. Mm.
Yes, yes. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute because I want to go right back to the beginning of, well, almost the beginning of the band to think about a couple of icons, I suppose you could call them. And that is on the original front cover of Time and a Word, which is one of the controversial ones, which didn't appear, I don't think, in the US. It was a different cover because it's got this naked woman on it and a butterfly. And that's a very recognisable, against the sort of checkerboard, isn't it? So it's a very recognisable, if controversial image. And then what Roger Dean did, Roger Dean wasn't involved with the band at that time, of course, but when they produced Yesterday's, the sort of not really greatest hits album at all, but a sort of sampler of what Yes had done previously, when Yesterday's came out, he copied that image from Time and the Word because there were quite a few bits of Time and the Word on this album, and he had it floating in the background on the Yesterday's front cover. So, yeah, it's nice to see that kind of reference in terms of the graphics back to an earlier time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the funny thing is that cover you mentioned wasn't available in the US and it wasn't on the Canadian pressing either.
Mm.
They didn't allow it either for whatever reason. But it is funny that this image became connected with Time and a Word. You know what I mean? Like, so when they did that best of, I kind of always look at Yesterday's as like the best of, not a greatest hits, right?
Yeah.
And having that on there immediately makes you think back to Time and a Word, which I think was sort of a good idea that Roger Dean did that, because how else would you have kind of attached that era to the cover? I mean, I'm not really sure how he attached the debut album to it. I can't visualize it right now, but it is nice though that he did have something to connect with for that cover. And you know what I find even more interesting about that is that I always suspect that artists are sort of like singers. They never want to use other people's work except their own. They're very egotistical that way, I find. But the fact that he actually took an image that was done by a different artist and used it in his own shows a little bit of a kind of a coolness to it, that he was okay with doing that, you know?
Yes, indeed. And it certainly is a very striking image on the cover of Yesterday's. And carrying on our discussion about Roger Dean and his icons, the next images that I sent over to you, Mark, are from his book, his Dragon's Dream that's the publishing company, I think, Dragon's Dream book called Views. And there it is, the ship. Now, I'm just going to call it the Roger Dean ship for now, just because I don't know what it's supposed to be called. So that's in white on black, a sort of silhouette, reverse silhouette. But later on in the book, there is a scarlet red against a blue background version of this, and it's really quite a stunning image. And then if you go on further in time, you will see that same trademark, as it were, of Roger Dean appears on Fragile, inside the gatefold, on Close to the Edge, on Yes Songs. When he comes back to the band in 1980 on Drama, you can find it on the inside cover again there. And even on things like Steve Howe solo albums, you'll find that Roger Dean icon there as well. Going right up to date with Fly From Here and Heaven and Earth all have this very characteristic icon of Roger Dean there. And yes, it's not everywhere, but it's almost everywhere that you see his work.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny when you send me all these pictures with it on there, it almost becomes something like you want to slap yourself in the forehead that you didn't notice this throughout the years, like how it's so obvious now when you look at it that it's, you know, something connected to him, and you don't even realize how many times you've actually seen it until you get these pictures. You know, you're like, oh yeah, I remember seeing that. And it shows right here too, like later on, like when they're doing like a Fly From Here, it's now pretty much beside any sort of text dealing with them. Like it says paintings and logos by Roger Dean, and that little image is right beside it now.
Yes. Right?
Before it was just sometimes just randomly put in the artwork or it was, you know, somewhere in a corner or something. But now, as we get later on in his career, he kind of just attaches it to anything that has to do with him. Even his www.rogerdean.com, right beside it is that image, right?
Yes.
So yeah, it's become definitely kind of that's like his Eddie, like Iron Maiden has Eddie.
Oh yeah.
Their logos, their image guy, their icon there, and this is his Eddie.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. I think that's a very good point. And what I've done here as well also is included, and you can see these in the show notes, as I say, included some of the images of the original ship, which was on the Fragile cover, and then the story carried on to the to Yes Songs, didn't it? And Yes Shows, where the story carries on of the Fragile world breaking apart, and then the different parts of it being shepherded by this ship through the galaxy to find a new home and to grow into new things there, which is such a wonderful story and idea. And clearly that ship is a very different ship to the plane that Roger uses essentially as part of his logo, as part of his copyright image, I suppose, in a way. And I also wanted to just mention as well, you sent me very kindly a copy of the Steve Howe album, which was a Canadian copy.
Yes.
And that's another piece of iconography, which is not necessarily associated just with Yes, of course, it's associated with the country, with Canada. Now, that's Maple Leaf, I'm assuming that is, Mark. And I'm assuming that is everywhere you look in your country of Canada.
Yes, the Maple Leaf is very much a fixture of Canada. You know, it's on our flag, obviously. And it's also in a lot of different images around the country. If when you go down the highways, you'll see it on like road signs and stuff like that. And it every sort of Canadian record pressing you'll get, you'll see that little leaf there in a corner somewhere on the back cover representing the Canadian pressing, which is, I think, very smart that they did that, because when people, record collectors going around saying, you know, how do I find a Canadian pressing? You know, there's ways you can see it, obviously, where you can see like the country of origin down at the bottom, like where it was pressed or where it was made. But having such an easy to see emblem like that makes it that much easier to collect a Canadian pressing. So it is a very standout image in that sense. So I always thought that that whole leaf thing was very, very well done and a very strong image for Canada.
Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it, that other countries haven't taken that idea and put some kind of logo or icon to show what their pressings are. It is a shame.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can't go any further talking about Yes iconography without mentioning the Elias of Sun Hilo logo, image, whatever you want to call it. And again, please leave a comment on the show notes if you know what the official name of that logo is. So this appeared first on the back cover of Elias of Sun Hilo, and this was the artwork done not by Roger Dean. And the story is, that I've read, is that Roger Dean was just too busy to do this project at the time when John Anderson was doing his first solo album, Elias of Sun Hilo. So it comes up with this on the back, and it's another instantly, for Yes fans, instantly recognisable symbol. And the number of times that John has used this is quite incredible. But the original there, with its sort of stylized circle and the triangle and the square all knitted in together, it's, again, an unforgettable icon, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually one of the more stronger Yes related imagery that I think that's out there. I mean, I know it's connected more to John himself, right? Yeah. But, I mean, whenever you see it, it's such a striking image. And the great thing about it, too, is that it became such a attachment, such a part of John Anderson, that when they did Union, they actually had that image in his area there, like hovering over top of him almost there. And it was really cool to see it. I remember when I saw them in concert, and I saw that, like, it immediately was stood out on the stage. It was like, wow, I remember... When I saw it, I was like, "Hey, I know that," because I had recently at that time just gotten into that album, so it was kind of cool. And I was kind of secretly hoping, "Are they going to play something off that album?" Like, I kind of thought that they would like do something, right? But you know, I've always kind of wondered what the meaning of it is, because when you kind of break it down, it's like a circle, a square, and a triangle, right? And it almost makes you think back to like the Harry Potter thing,
you know, that's right.
with the cloak, the invisibility, the cloak of invisibility, the resurrected stone, and you know, and then the
wand, isn't it?
Yeah, the wand.
So
I'm wondering if there's some sort of similar thinking in that.
Yes, it's one of those iconic. Well, I keep using that word. Iconic images that I think you can trace back through time, and if you have a quick look on Google, as I have done, there are things like the Philosopher's Stone, which is the original title of the first Harry Potter book. I know it's called something different, the Sorcerer's Stone, isn't it, in America? But the Philosopher's Stone, it was a concept dreamt up hundreds of years ago, before J.K. Rowling even got hold of it, of course. And yes, that has a different arrangement of these three symbols, I think, the circle, the square, and the triangle. And those are sort of three basic human symbols, aren't they? Those three. And yes, you're right. John Anderson has used this in concert, in Yes concerts, many times. And I remember it distinctly, and the image that I've included here from the magnification, from the symphonic tour, where he had this icon behind him. And also in my research for my Tormato book, the Elias of Sun Hilo logo is painted onto the dais, onto the central circular stage bit that John Anderson stood on most memorably in the middle of the stage and high above everybody else and looking out over the audience. And you can see that in the image I've put onto the show notes as well. But I also wanted to talk about the 3D version of the Elias of Sun Hilo Yes-related logo design, which our friend Bob Seska put together for Symphonic Live. So if you've seen the 3D graphics that he put together, he converted that symbol into a 3D version with a stand, and it stands up like that. And I can't remember now, I'll have to go back and listen to our conversation with Bob about this, but he created this thing called the harmonic convergence engine or something rather, and I think this may be part of it. So this is a fantastic 3D version of it, and it includes some spheres and some other little elements into it, but beautifully done. And it's in some of the versions of magnification that you can pick up, particularly the LP versions, the vinyl versions, but a fantastic reworking, I think.
yeah, it's definitely a very strong image of it. The funny thing is that the original one seems very much more prehistoric, almost kind of like back in the, you know, the old times. And this is sort of like the modernistic sort of, you know, 10,000 years in the future yes. version of it that they tried to devise it. Like, it's almost like some adventurer stumbled across the symbol in some deep forest somewhere. Yeah. And then he just decided that it was some sort of design of an engine or something. And he designed this 3D thing to sort of see what would happen if he gave it power and what would happen if it moved. Or, you know, I could see that 3D design being some sort of mechanism that yes. they thought was from the design. Because the funny thing is, I just saw here on the internet, if you could just humor me for a second here, it says here about this image, it says, the symbol represents the concept of oneness with God and diversity and acts as a reminder of our paths back to God through finding our oneness and embracing our diversity.
Absolutely. What else could sound more John Anderson than that? That's perfect, exactly. Isn't it? Yeah. Yes, and I think Bob's done a fantastic job of converting that, and as you say, making it into a sort of more futuristic, more science fiction than the original sort of fantasy version which appeared on Elias of Sunhillo. But yes, another, for us Yes fans, another instantly recognisable icon. Now, as we know, the band have not always used Roger Dean, and notably in the Hypnosis era, so that'll be the 77 Going for the One and Tormato, but then particularly in the 80s, when 90125, Big Generator, Talk, those sorts of albums used very different iconography. But I do I've always liked the logo that they used both on the cover of Big Generator and also later on Love Will Find a Way, for example, had this version of the Y, which is, I don't know how to describe it really, but it's quite different. But again, I think quite recognizable and quite stylish.
Yeah, it is really interesting. It almost looks like a sort of odd tuning fork there.
Yes.
But the funny thing is, if you look at it, the one image looks like a Y, as you said. And if you look at the other one underneath the circle underneath it, if you turn it sideways, it looks like an E. As well.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to connect those two circular things, you could make an S out of that. So maybe it was just a sort of way of making a yes thing out of that imagery, right? Which is, that's some people might say, Mark, you're stretching it a bit here. But, you know, you could do it. I mean, the Y and the E look obvious to me. The S you'd have to probably do a little bit of thinking about. But
Yeah. That's very good, though. I'd never thought of it like that. But again, in a way, I'm disappointed in a way that didn't stay around for very long at all. And once Roger Dean was back and we were getting towards the millennium for the Ladder, and I think possibly earlier than that as well, but the Ladder is the obvious example, he abandoned the original Yes logo. And we're not talking about logos which have lettering in them this week. That's not the point. But I did just want to mention I think they call it the Chops logo, the Yes logo, which is supposed to be Japanese inspired, I think. So it's the E, we've just been talking about E, but the E is just three horizontal strokes, isn't it? And again, I've always liked that, although it's clearly not the classic Yes logo. But what did you think of that Chops logo?
I didn't mind it, actually, because, I mean, I am a big fan of Japanese things. I love the country in general and sort of landscapes that they have and stuff like that. And I've always thought of Japanese people as being extremely strong people. I mean, the amount of times that they've had earthquakes and tsunamis affect their country, and they've still come back to have such a beautiful country, it's just unbelievable. But I always thought that their sort of artistic sense is very interesting as well, and their written texts are always interesting as well. So I always gravitated to this as well. I always liked the way he also wrote the Ladder out too. It was very interesting as well.
Yeah, that's a great, I mean, I think around that time he was starting to have even more elaborate lettering, wasn't he? Even more elaborate fonts and so on. Very, very enjoyable. But we're not supposed to be talking about that. And the last point I want to make is that we've talked about his trademark, as it were, his sign, his own identity, graphic identity, being connected with that ship or aeroplane that he created. Yes. But in fact, the most recent album by Yes, Mirror to the Sky, with all the fantastic graphic elements by Roger Dean, doesn't in fact have that logo on it at all anywhere, or at least not the versions I've got anyway. But it does have a little, I mean, it looks like a stamp. But if you compare that on the show notes, a little red stamp at the side of one of the pages, if you compare it to the Dragon's Dream logo, I think it's a reworking of that. And again, another way that he's showing that this artwork is by him. But interesting that he didn't use the aeroplane in this latest Yes production.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing that he's trying to, like, you know, morph that image into something new. Like, I think artists in this sense also are kind of like musicians. They always kind of want to try to, you know, further their art, you know, move forward. They don't want to stay the same. And maybe I'm not going to say that he got tired of it, but I'm going to say that maybe he had another idea of how to, you know, further the image a bit. And maybe this is another, you know, this is like version 3 of his sort of logo, you know?
Yeah. Fascinating. So perhaps we'll be able to get Roger on to come and talk to us and tell us about that.
But there is one image, though, that we have not touched on, which I was sort of surprised.
Go on then, yes.
And I am curious to get your opinion on this one, if you think this is a relevant one to speak of or not. On the Yes album, on the back, they had that mannequin head.
Okay. The mannequin head, yes, of course.
Now, the funny thing is, the reason why I bring that up is because if you watch the video of them doing Yours Is No Disgrace on that television program, that head is constantly twirling and spinning during the performance of it, almost like they were trying to incorporate this mannequin head as some sort of identification to that Yes album.
Yeah.
Would you say that's a relevant one to speak of?
I think it is, and thank you for bringing it up, because I had completely forgotten that. And when we had the London version of the 50th anniversary fan convention, and David Watkinson brought a huge exhibition of his memorabilia, Yes memorabilia, the one thing that everybody was most interested in was this styrofoam head that he had. And it didn't even look identical to the original one, but people were absolutely fascinated by it and having their photographs taken next to it. I suppose it's one of those things that is easy to recognize again and iconic. Yes. And I'm sure that after that photo session, they probably just threw the thing away. But maybe if things had been different, they might have kept hold of that and used it as part of their visual identity, which would have been great fun.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it funny, though, that 50 years later, Yes fans remember that and want to get their photograph with it. Like it's almost like a member of the band. I must have my photo with that mannequin head, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
$5 for a picture with the mannequin head.
I wonder if anyone's ever found one identical to that vintage one, perhaps. I know Keith Hoisington, actually, I read on Facebook that he'd bought one of those recently. So, Keith, if you're listening, let us know how close it is or whether it's from the same period as that. But yes, it's been fascinating to think about this aspect of the band's visual identity, which perhaps we don't consider very often, and it's good fun to do so. So thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Six. On bread. Yes. Music. Six.
Yes Music Podcast, 600 episodes.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller and Jeffrey Cresselius. Yes Music Podcast patrons, half of them, are Mark Baggs, John Cowan, John Parry, Dave Owen, Simon Barrow, Steve Scott, Terence Sadler, Steve Deal, Robert Naser, Fergus Cubbage, William Hayes, Jeff Bailey, and incidentally, happy birthday to Jeff Bailey, Stephen Raw, Lobate Scarp, Jeffrey Mason, Dave Watkinson, Tim Stannard, Robert Vanderveer, Brian Sullivan, David Pannell, Jamie McQuinn, Miguel Falcao, Paul Tomei, Michael O'Connor, Brian Harris, H.P. Peterson, Guy DeRome, and Aaron Steelman. As always, thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them to help keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, please do head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We do hope to be back next week. In the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via x.com, Facebook, or Instagram. And also check out anthem52.com if you like that kind of thing. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.